We're in the chapter 2 of Galatians. Okay, so in the first chapter of Galatians, it's been a while since we've been over that. We saw that Paul was talking about how the gospel is the good news. And Paul seems to be making a very strong point that the gospel that he is presenting is the gospel that was given directly to him by God. And I would submit to you that the gospel that was given to Paul was given to Paul by God, but basically through the scripture. All Paul needed was basically some correction in his view of that, because the gospel is really the gospel that's the Messiah spoke about. It's the same gospel that's in all of the prophets. It's the gospel that basically Moses actually began to talk about before he died. And the gospel is simply this, that God is going to take and scatter Israel out, and he's going to draw them back to himself. And all of the prophets agree on this. There is very little in there. And if you look at the prophecies that all down through the Tanakh, you'll find that practically all the prophecies add to this gospel message that God is going to scatter Israel and draw Israel back. But what Paul wants to do is he wants to separate himself from many of the various gospel messages that were out in that day. And one big gospel message is sort of the same message, but it was tainted off a little bit, and it was tainted by the Pharisees. And so Paul wants to separate himself in some way from that. And this is what he's telling the Galatian people. He's trying to show them that the message that he's conveying to them is a message that was given to him. And he's really upset with them because they have so quickly left that message. So as we get into chapter 2, Paul continues on with his substantiation, you might say, or the case he's trying to lay, that what he has been given is of higher authority than what whoever's coming in, the perpetrators that are coming in, his authority for his gospel message is of a higher authority than what these people that are coming in amongst the Galatians is bringing. And so we get into Galatians chapter 2, and we start in verse 1, and Paul there is continuing on with the thought of the first chapter. And in chapter 2, and I'm reading out of the English Standard Version because it sort of flows better, not necessarily it's really any better. But Galatians 1 and chapter 1 and chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, says, "Then after 14 years I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. And I went up because of a revelation and set before them, though privately before those who seemed influential, the gospel that I proclaimed among the Gentiles, in order to make sure I was not running or had not run in vain." So, in these two verses, Paul begins to show that this message that he had been given and that he had been preaching now for 14 years, he apparently had a little question about, or he was getting questioned about it. But for whatever reason, and actually Paul gives the reason, he says he went up by revelation. And this is the same thing that he said earlier, that he was given this gospel by revelation. So now he's saying he was by revelation instructed or moved to go to Jerusalem and have them check, have the people in Jerusalem at least listen to him and see if basically what he had been saying was actually true. So, let's see. Now, you know, he had already met now with Peter and James. We see that in the previous chapter. But now he's discussing this with some other people in Jerusalem. Not just Peter and James, but he's discussing this with some others. The text indicates that the people that Paul was going to meet with were influential people. People that could move others. And that's an interesting statement there. As you look into the Greek of it, if I say Hebrew, I mean Greek when I'm dealing with the New Testament. But if you look at the Greek term, the term used there for influential or of reputation, some of your translations may have of reputation. The word there is dokia, and it's Strong's number 1380. And the word dokia is used quite often in the Bible. It's used by Yeshua. It's used by a number of people in the Bible. But it almost always means to think or to suppose or surmise. In other words, it's a term that has to do with using your head. You're thinking about what you're doing. You're not necessarily stuck in a box. You're thinking. One of the places it's used is in Matthew 6, verse 7. And this is Yeshua speaking, and he says, "And when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think, or dokia, that they may be heard for their many words." So these are people who are they're thinking about what they're doing. They're thinking. And probably a better example is in the book of Luke. And of course, Luke is presumed to have some Greek ancestry because he has a non-Hebrew name. And in Luke it says, "Now as they heard these things, he spoke another parable, because he was near Jerusalem, because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately." There the word thought is dokia. So they're thinking about the kingdom. They're thinking about what's coming on. And so these people that Paul was going up to Jerusalem to meet with or discuss this with were people that may have been influential, but I think the important part of it is that these were people who were actually thinking about these things. Now, and when it comes to religion, the people who really think about things in the Bible are a separate section, or they're a subset of all people in religion, right? There's a lot of people that they'll go to church and they'll sit down and they'll listen to their sermon and their thoughts on the football game or whatever else is going on, but they're not really thinking about what they're doing. But within almost every congregation, there's a subset of people who are actually thinking and actually turning to their Bible and looking and seeing what it said. And I think this is what Paul is trying to do. He's trying to discuss these thoughts that are coming into his mind, and he wants to verify, or maybe he wants to bounce his ideas off these people in Jerusalem in order to get their opinion, to make sure, and of course this is his words, he wants to make sure he's not running in vain. He's not teaching in vain. He's not teaching a wrong message. And that's something that's very important for all of us to do, to be thinking and always concerned about the message. Does the message actually line up with Scripture? Okay, I tried to convey a message today that Rachel said didn't line up with Scripture. So, and she was right, you know, and this is how we learn about these things. We bounce these things off of each other, and this is iron sharpening iron. And this is what Paul was wanting to do. So thus he went to Jerusalem to meet with some people who could actually discuss these things with him and were interested in them. And again, Paul's trip there was motivated by revelation. Apparently God put it in his heart to have this message checked out, to make sure that he was right on, that he was continuing, or maybe he needed to have it refined. And think about that for a second. If God puts it in your mind, and if you're a teacher, and if God puts it in your heart that you need to have what you're teaching checked out, that's somewhat of a frightening thing. Because to think that you may have been leading people astray because you misunderstood is not a very good thing. And so Paul, probably as he was headed up to Jerusalem, had some deep thoughts about what he had been teaching all along, and was really concerned that he may have been leading some people astray, because, you know, Paul had a history behind him. And he had, for the better part of his early life, had led a lot of people astray by taking and persecuting people who were actually doing the right thing. Probably was a part of having maybe even some people put to death. So Paul is one of those persons who doesn't want to, you know, he learns from history, his own history, and because he's learning from history, he knows now he needs to really think these things through and get other people's input on these things. He doesn't want to go through life teaching the wrong thing. So he's going to Jerusalem. He's going to lay it all out before him, before these people in Jerusalem. So now we go into Galatians verse 3, chapters 2, verse 3. We'll read down through verse 5. And it says, "But even Titus, who was with me, was not forced to be circumcised, though he was Greek. Yet because a false brother secretly brought in, who slipped in to spy out our freedom that we have in Jesus Christ, so that they might bring us into slavery, to them we did not yield in submission even for a moment, so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved in you," or for you. This is the English Standard Version of that rendering, rendering out of the Greek, and it is very choppy. And all the translations of Paul's writings from this point down through the end of this chapter are pretty choppy, because Paul is, I would characterize Paul as someone who thinks faster than he can write. And so, if you know how that is, sometimes I'm typing along and my mind's racing and I'm typing and I find out I've typed a lot of gibberish because I'm thinking quicker than my fingers are moving. And I would suggest Paul was probably saying things to his scribe a lot quicker than he could write them down. And so you have some broken half sentences and you have sentences that really are not even complete. And Tim Haig did a commentary on Galatians, and he makes this point that it's so broken that it's really hard to understand, and you have to really look at the context of what he's saying to get an idea of what Paul is talking about. So in this passage right here, Paul is talking about something. He's talking about these people. Well, basically, he's talking about Titus being brought in to be circumcised, and he was not circumcised. And then he jumps into this concept or this idea of these false brothers who were secretly brought in. And so you don't really know the point that he was trying to bring about with Titus, because he leaves it and this goes to something else. And so because of this, we have some confusion. But so we'll just take Paul of what we have and try to make sense out of it based on what he's given us here. One of the things we know for sure is that Paul brought Titus and Barnabas with him to Jerusalem. Now, Barnabas was a Jew. He was born a Jew. Actually, he was a Levite born in Cyprus. We see that in Acts 4, verse 36. So bringing Barnabas to Jerusalem was not a problem, because Barnabas could basically go anywhere in Jerusalem. And if he wanted to go worship at the temple, he could go worship at the temple. And going to Jerusalem almost always included worshiping at the temple, because you were bringing your sacrifices and all of this to Jerusalem, and your purpose was to draw near to God. That was one of the big motivations for going to Jerusalem for any Jew. And so if Paul had business in Jerusalem, I'm sure that he would have visited the temple while he was there. But Titus is a different person. Because Titus, we know very little about Titus, except that Paul says he's a Greek. And being a Greek can mean a number of things. We need to get a little bit of a background culture of the Israelite people, the Jewish people in the first century, to understand what it meant to be a Greek. And what we need to do is go back to the story of the Maccabees. And we know that in the story of the Maccabees, the Greek warrior Alexander the Great went through and basically took over that whole area of Asia, Lower Asia there, called Asia Minor, I think, and basically tried to change that whole area into a Greek culture. And of course, Antiochus died. And he turned it over to his four generals. And eventually a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes became the leader of the Seleucid Empire, which had control of the land that we would consider now Israel. And so Antiochus was a zealot, you might say, in wanting to promote the Greek culture. And he made it to where the laws of the land were basically you convert to whatever you call the Greek religion, and under the threat of death or various other things. And so he pushed his Greek culture all through the area, and many of the Jewish people converted to this type of religion, or at least accepted some of these things. They began to stop studying the Torah. They began to stop keeping the festivals. Some of them even tried to change their physical circumcision to make it appear that they had not been circumcised. So this is how low the Jewish people had come, not all the Jewish people, but some of the Jewish people had come during that day in order to take and fit into the Greek culture. Well, the Maccabees, their purpose was to try to overthrow the Greek culture, is basically, in a nutshell, is what it was all about. And over a period of time, you had the Pharisees come on the scene, and the Pharisees did more to try to eliminate the Greek culture from within Judaism. So, that when you come down to the first century, when you have a Greek person, or a person who's born Greek, then you automatically consider, or think in the back of your mind, what happened to our people because of the Greeks. And that is, the nation of the Jewish people were almost destroyed, or could have been destroyed, because of that. So there's a lot of friction between the Jews and a person who considered himself to be Greek. And here now, Paul is going to be bringing this Greek fellow into Jerusalem. There are a number of problems with being Greek besides what I talked about, and there's sort of some, one of those is laid out or spelled out in Acts 6 verse 1. This is the story of the early assemblies, believing assemblies coming together. And it says in Acts 6 verse 1, "Now in these days, when the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint by the Hellenists arose against the Hebrews because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution." The word Hellenist is the word from which we get Greek, basically. A Hellenist person is a Greek person, a Greek thinking person. And actually, the word Hellenist is almost always translated Grecian in many, many Bibles. So we see that even at this point here, amongst the believers, there's friction between the Hellenists, the Greeks, and the Jews. And this is within the believing community. So this Grecian background exposes itself and comes to a head even within those communities. By the time of the first century, the word Hellenist had morphed into a number of meanings, actually. And all these different meanings you have to understand based on the context of what's going on. I'll list four possible meanings for a person who would be considered a Hellenist or a Grecian. They're the same thing. Hellenist or a Grecian, it depends on how your Bible translates the word. A Hellenist could be a Jew who spoke Greek. In other words, if you were a Jew that could not speak Hebrew and you spoke Greek, you could be considered a Hellenist. A non-observant Jew could be considered a Hellenist. A person who is born to at least one Greek parent and one Jewish parent could be considered a Hellenist, especially if the Jewish parent was the mother. If the Jewish parent was the father, then you would have been considered a Greek. Timothy had a Jewish mother and a Hebrew or Jewish. No, you got to cut that back. Yeah, I got that correct. Timothy had a Jewish mother and a Greek father. Okay? And then another obvious understanding of being a Hellenist or a Grecian would be a person who had absolutely no Jewish heritage. If you had absolutely no Jewish heritage, you could be considered a Greek. Now, I'm saying no Jewish heritage. I'm not saying no Israelite heritage. In the first century, if you had no Jewish heritage, you could be considered a Greek. And then there's one other explanation, or one other use of the word Greek, or Grecian, Hellenist, and that is simply that you are a heathen. If you were a Grecian, you could be considered a heathen. And that would be because all the Greeks pretty much were understood to be pagans. And so just simply being Greek, you're automatically thinking pagan. All right? The Strong's definition for the word Hellenist, the word Hellenist comes from the word Hellenistes, the Strong's number 1675, and it means one who imitates the manners and customs of or the worship of the Greeks and use the Greek tongue. So a Hellenist could be one who imitates the manners and customs or the worship of the Greeks. So if you've got a Jew, like they did during the time of the Maccabees, who tried to reverse his circumcision so that he could appear to be Greek, he would be considered a Hellenist, right? Okay. Another explanation or definition out of Strong's is for Hellenist is that it's used in the New Testament of Jews born in foreign lands and speaking Greek. So like I said earlier, just simply not understanding Hebrew and speaking in the Greek language would make you a Hellenist. And the word Hellenistes comes from the word Hellen, which Strong's defines as a Greek, either by nationality, whether a native of the mainland or the Greek islands or colonies. And in a wider sense, the name embraces all nations, not Jews, that made the language, customs, and learning of the Greeks their own. The primary reference is to a different religion or worship. So if you had a different religion or worship from the Jewish religion or worship, then you were considered a Greek. Okay? So if you're a Jew, born a Jew, circumcised on the eighth day, but then you went and adopted the Greek religions, the Jews would consider you a Greek, right? A Greek. It's interesting to understand, and very important to understand, because not all Greeks are Greeks. Okay? In the Acts 6 case that we mentioned earlier, we don't know for sure who the Hellenists were. We don't know if they were Hebrews. We don't know if they were Jews. God just calls them Hellenist. In fact, one of the persons that it's widely understood to have been a Hellenist in that period of time was this guy named Stephen. Okay, and the reason Stephen was considered a Hellenist was because Stephen had a non-Hebrew name. Stephen is not Hebrew. It's a Greek name. It's like Timothy. Timothy is a Greek name. It's not a Hebrew name. Mark is a Hebrew name. All right. So Jonathan is a Hebrew name. But my name is not. And so Stephen's name was not. So he was considered by many, not necessarily the Bible, but by many theologians to be a Greek. But yet, what did Stephen do? Stephen spoke very boldly for God, right? And he obviously knew the Hebrew culture very well because he was basically able to recite the entire history of Israel in one sitting. So he's pretty sharp guy for a Greek, if he was indeed a Greek. So getting back to Titus, all we know is that he was born a non-Jew. That's all we can really say. Or we really can't even say that. We could say that he was Titus may have been born a Jew, though he was given a non-Jewish name. So he probably wasn't born a Jew. But we know that he was simply not Jewish in understanding and practice at the time that he began to work with Paul. At least that's what we can surmise. I don't even think we can absolutely surmise that. I guess the best thing to say about Titus is that Titus has a Greek name. And so somewhere along the way, he's been coming in. But The point to the Jewish people, though, is that Titus was a Greek, and Paul calls him a Greek. And so to bring this Greek to Jerusalem is a touchy thing for Paul to do. Now, one of the things that some of the commentaries say about Titus is that Titus may simply be a nickname for Timothy. And if that's the case, then Titus had a Jewish mother and a Greek father, if Titus is indeed the Jewish name or a shortcut nickname for Timothy. Now, when Paul talks about taking Titus to Jerusalem, it says that he had not been compelled to be circumcised. Okay, Titus had not been compelled to be circumcised. But if Titus had been compelled to be circumcised, who do we think would have compelled Titus to be circumcised? It would have probably been Paul. If there is a need for Titus to be circumcised, then it seems like Paul would have been the one who would have compelled him to do so. But we know that Paul did not compel him to be circumcised. So why does Paul bring this up? Why in his writings does he bring up the point that Titus wasn't circumcised and that he had not taken and compelled Paul to be circumcised? I would submit to you that the reason why is because there were false brethren who were brought in, according to the text, to check Paul out. And one of the things that they wanted to see is if Paul was doing things according to what you might say the standard way of bringing or proselytizing. Because in Judaism in the first century, there is a particular way things were done. But Paul says that Paul says that he did not compel Titus to be circumcised, and he was going to go ahead and he was going to bring Titus to Jerusalem. And so basically in this statement, Paul is showing that he was not intimidated by this false brethren who were brought in. So let's talk a little bit about circumcision then. Because Paul's making a big point about circumcision here. And we've got to understand that in the first century, there was circumcision and then there was circumcision. There's two different things. There's two different meanings to this whole idea of circumcision. First one we need to bring out is the most obvious, and that is that the Torah requires physical circumcision. We see that in all through the Torah, that God told Abraham to be circumcised, and then Moses mentions it a number of times. And circumcision was simply a sign of the covenant. And there's no question in that regard. In the first century, there's no question that physical circumcision was required for the people of God, to be considered a part of the people of God. God said that every Jewish person had to be circumcised. Every Israelite person basically had to be circumcised in order to be a part of the covenant. But one of the things that we don't understand and we don't see right at the surface is that the Jewish people, the Jewish leadership required not only circumcision, but they required that a person convert to Judaism to be considered a part of the people of God. The whole proselyte process concluded with a person becoming Jewish. Not necessarily Israelite, but becoming Jewish. And in most cases, the final act in becoming a Jew or a conversion to Judaism for a person who had not been circumcised was circumcision. But for a person who had been circumcised was what they call the Hatafat Dam Brit. Hatafat Dam Brief. If you want to find that on the internet, it's spelled Hatafat space Dam space Brit, Brit. And it literally means the drawing of a drop of blood. This is a practice that was started back sometime before the first century, it's surmised, and still continues today. If you were born Jewish today and you are circumcised on the eighth day, and then you go off and sow your wild oats to, you know, say, and maybe you become like this guy who's running for mayor of New York, a Jewish guy named Anthony Weiner. All right? We all know, I'm sure if you follow the news, you know about Anthony Weiner. But he's a Jewish guy who's obviously, according to his actions, gone off the deep end. And if he were to take and want to come back and start attending the synagogue again as an observant Jew, he would have to go through this ritual called Hatafat Dam Brit. And it's simply a drawing of a drop of blood. It's considered circumcision. Again, this Hatafat Dam Brit is nowhere dictated in the Torah. It is truly oral Torah. It's oral tradition. God never dictates this at all. It's a creation of the rabbis. And like I said, this, according to many commentaries, was a half or a first century custom amongst the Jewish people for bringing a non-Jew or a previous Jew back into covenant. Now, Paul is opposed to this because it basically flies in the face of the gospel message that Yahweh's given to him. Because Yahweh never says you have to do this in order to be a part of the people of God or to be drawn back into the people of God. What Yahweh says is you simply have to change your walk. You have to believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and change your walk and come back in. All right? Now, that's to get you in. If you're a non-Jew, then it would ultimately lead to circumcision. But if you are already circumcised, then you're circumcised. And so God did not require this little Hatafat Dam Brit thing. He just wanted a change of heart, basically, is what we were talking about today. And so when you couple the idea that the Jews were requiring this Hatafat Dam Brit, and that the Hatafat Dam Brit actually brought you into Judaism, this is where Paul had a problem. Because Paul saw that the Judaism that he had been a part of for all his life was not necessarily the walk of God. He saw that there were aspects of the walk of God in it, but he also saw that there were a lot of things added to the walk that God said you don't do. God said you cannot add or take away from the Torah, right? And so when you start adding things to the Torah and you start requiring those of people, especially new people coming into this, then Paul was looking at that as bondage. And this is one of the reasons why Paul, when he brought Titus up, he did not compel Titus to be circumcised. Now, Titus could have been circumcised if he'd wanted to be circumcised. And there's nothing saying that he never was circumcised. It just says in this particular instance, Paul did not compel Titus to be circumcised in order to come up to Jerusalem and be amongst the Jerusalem followers up there. Because Paul, I think, in this particular case, remember, Paul is still trying to support his view of the gospel. Paul is trying to emphasize that in his mind, this ritual circumcision thing was not required. And if he had compelled Titus to have been circumcised, then that would sort of lessen Paul's impact, because it would have been basically giving in to those people who were teaching another gospel, you might say. The ones who were trying to bring in a different aspect, or you might say to bring into the believing community the Judaisms of the day. Titus, in effect, represented freedom, because Titus was someone who is not, by the fact that he had not been compelled to be circumcised, Titus was a person who showed himself to be free from the Jewish oral Torah dogma, you might say. Now, as we look at these false brethren who've been brought in here in verse 3, I think it is. You wonder sometimes why these people were brought in. These false brethren were brought in to spy out on the freedom that the people in the congregations, the Galatian congregations, had. They were to spy it out, which would indicate that they were to be reporting back to other people. But notice that the spies that were brought in, they were to spy this out, but they were not to take and try to lessen the freedoms or the liberty or try to take away the liberty of the people that they were spying out on. They were simply there to take and find out what they were doing and why they were doing it. And Paul says they were trying to bring them under bondage. So what is the liberty that Paul's mentioning here? Is the liberty freedom from the Torah? Is it freedom from sin? What is it exactly that this liberty that Paul's talking about? Well, we can eliminate the concept that Paul's talking about of freedom from or liberty from Torah by simply going to the book of James. In James 1, verse 25, James says, "He who looks on the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but doer of the work, this one will be pleased in what he does." So James makes it very clear that liberty is found in the Torah. Paul himself in Romans 7 verse 12 says that the law is holy and the commandment holy, just, and good. So Paul obviously is not against the Torah. In fact, Romans is written after Galatians. And so we know that the Torah, according to Paul, was not bad at all. It was something that was good. And in fact, even in our culture today, up until a few years ago, I don't even know if we sing the song anymore, but in our culture, when I was going to grade school, we used to sing a song that goes like this. Oh, beautiful for pilgrim feet. You know the song? Well, the song, this stanza ends this. America, America, God mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control. Thy liberty in law. So we used to sing that law is what brought us liberty. And we're finding out today that leaders who are not willing to live within the law take away your liberty, don't they? So liberty and law go hand in hand. So when Paul's talking about liberty, he's talking about law. The people who had been brought, who had found liberty, or people who are now attaching themselves once again to the Torah of God. It's not freedom to do what you want. It's a freedom to walk in God's way. And another aspect of this freedom is that these people were now free from sin, or more importantly, they were free from the consequences of sin. Now, I'm not saying that there's no more sin, and I'm not saying that there's not penalties for sin. What I'm saying is this. There was sin that caused them to be in the state of exile that they were finding themselves in. And we find that back in Deuteronomy 28, verses 58 through 64. And I'll just read a portion of that. It says, "If you do not carefully observe all the words of this law," in other words, if you sin, "that are written within this book, then the Lord will scatter you among the Gentiles from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods which neither you nor your fathers have known, wood or stone." So what these people were finding liberty from is the consequences of the sins of their fathers that caused them to be an exiled people and in the state of bondage that they had found themselves in. Bondage to all these pagan gods, pagan religions, and all of that stuff there. So their freedom was found by coming into the Torah. And by coming into the Torah, you are turning around, you might say, the cause of the exile. Now, we're all in exile today. We're still in exile because of the sins of our fathers, because of the sins of those as a result of the sins of Jeroboam, you might say. And so we're hopefully restoring Torah, and by restoring Torah, we restore liberty. So these believers were free from the exile, and they were being brought back to God, to the God of Israel, just as the gospel said. The gospel said that he was going to send, that there would come this Messiah, and the Messiah would draw Israel back. And along with drawing Israel back, there would be others who would be drawn, that would be drawn with them. And Paul says that he was unwilling in verse 5, Paul says that he's unwilling to take even for an hour to compromise his view of the gospel, which is this freedom and liberty by Torah, as a result, as opposed to going back into bondage by getting yourself under man-made law, which they had just come out of. They had just come out of the pagan religions and the man-made laws there. He doesn't want them to jump from one ditch into another ditch into another set of man-made law called oral Torah. All right, so let's go down to verse 6. I want to put verse 6 all by itself. And it says, Verse 6, but from those who seem to be something, whatever they were, it makes no difference to me. God shows personal favoritism to no man. For those who seem to be something added nothing to me. Those who seem to be something or influential added nothing to me. Paul seems to be linking those people who seem to be influential, he links those people to this group above, in the verses above. There's a little bit of confusion right here because a lot of people think that those who seem to be influential are James, Peter, and John. But I don't think the text supports that. The text seems to support more that these people that seem to be influential are the ones who also were the ones who brought in the false brethren. The false brethren of chapter or verse 4. Now, why do I say that? The words that translated there appear to be influential, and in some cases, like in the King James Version, says seem to be somewhat. You may have that in yours. That word there is the same Greek word that we saw earlier. It's dokia. It's the word that means thinkers. So these people that Paul was going to go up to Jerusalem and he was going to see these thinkers, and these thinkers were to be help him to understand this. Well, these people seem to be the same people that Paul is dealing with in his congregations, or the same type of group, or same type of people. So could it be that Paul went to Jerusalem to confer with them, and that they in turn, because this is where he started talking sequentially here, could it be that after Paul went there to Jerusalem to talk to these people and told them about what he was going on with him, that these people now sent these spies back to the congregations? And I'll just throw out sort of a scenario here as to why that may be the case. Just think about it for a second. You've got some congregation. Say you're some big church leader. And someone comes out from another area, and he comes to you and says, "Hey, look what we're doing." He says, I need to toss this off of you. You know, bounce this off of you. What I mean, I need to bounce this idea off of you. I've been teaching out here that these people are able to come into the congregation of Israel, and they need to, and they could become just as good of an Israelite as you and I are becoming an Israelite. And man, our little synagogues are just filling up. And we're getting all these people coming in and all these more. And then if you throw in the term, and we're getting all these tithes in, then, though that's not what Paul did. But just think about it. If you're out there and you're going into the big headquarters church and you're saying, what I'm doing out here is bringing all these people in, then wouldn't you from the headquarters want to go out and see what he's doing to try to bring, that's causing all these people to come in? And so you send your little spies down there to see what he's doing because you want to incorporate these things too. But you get your little spies down there, and the spies down there are coming back and reporting, and they're saying, well, the reason he's getting all these people come in is because he tells them they don't have to be circumcised. We know they have to be circumcised, so we can't get these people to come in because we know they're supposed to be circumcised. And Paul's telling them, no, that's how he's getting all these people to come in. Well, this is, I believe, what the scenario is that Paul's talking about. And what Paul finds out then is that these people in this headquarters church, you might say, in Jerusalem, they're up there and they're teaching a gospel, but they've got some added things to the gospel that Paul's not putting in there because he doesn't want to add to the gospel message. And he's seeing this friction between them now. And what more he's saying, though, is that these people who are these thinkers in Jerusalem, these people who are influential, he's seeing that they're motivated not necessarily by the gospel, but they're motivated probably more on increasing their numbers, maybe motivated more on money, or more they're motivated on being more powerful. Okay? Because when you look at what Paul says here in verse 6, he says, but from those who seem to be in something, whatever they were, it makes no difference to me. In other words, Paul used to think these people were something, but now he doesn't think they're something anymore because now he sees something in them that's not good. And then Paul goes on and says, God shows personal favoritism to no man. What that literally means that God sees the face, or God concerns himself with the face of a man. In other words, how you appear to be is not what's important to God. If what you really are is what God is concerned with. So these people were putting on a face, these influential people were putting on a face, but their actions did not support what they were, the image that they were trying to convey. So Paul basically says, I'm no longer believing these people are something important. And so then he goes down to verse 7. In verse 7 it says, on the contrary, when they saw that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the circumcised, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel to the circumcised, for he who worked through Peter for his apostolic ministry to the circumcised worked also through me for mine to the Gentiles. And when James and Paul, or Peter and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave me the right hand of fellowship. They gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. Only they asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do. So in verse 7, we have it starting off here, but on the contrary. So Paul here in verse 7 is contrasting the people he's getting ready to talk about with the people he had just talked about. The people he had just talked about were a bunch of flakes. though at one time Paul thought they were somewhat influential. And he's going to contrast them now to these people who he's getting ready to talk about. And who are those who he's getting ready to talk about? He's talking about Peter, James, and John, who seem to be pillars, or in other words, these were men who sort of held up the congregation. They supported the whole messianic belief, you might say, in first century Judaism. These were guys who were really had their heads on straight, though they made mistakes at times, but they had their heads on straight. But more importantly, their face and their walk matched. They didn't appear to be one thing and then become something else. So that's the difference that Paul is saying. He's contrasting these people. And what the point that Paul makes with these guys is that these guys were in full support of what Peter or what Paul was conveying. And we'll get to that in just a second. the word here for but in verse 7, in some of your translations it may be and, but it's the Hebrew word, or the Greek word, Allah, which means but, yet, or nevertheless. So it's very clearly Paul is making a contrast, not an inclusion in this regard. He's making a contrast between the Dokia, the thinkers, and Yeshua's disciples, who are also thinkers, but just thinking along a different line. Okay. Sometimes the confusion comes down in the word they, when it says, but on the contrary, when they saw that the gospel, many times that word they would lead you to believe it's talking about the first group of people. There again, it's just a matter you have to go with the context and see basically what Paul is talking about. Okay. There's some confusion here in verse 7 because the translators added a number of words that lead us to believe that there's a gospel for the Jews and a gospel for the Gentiles. Verse 7 says, but on the contrary, when they saw that the gospel for the uncircumcision had been committed to me as, and now you'll see, the gospel, and most of yours is in italics, that's added, for the circumcised, and then there's the word was to Peter, okay? It's in there by design to lead you to believe that there's two different gospels out there, one for the Gentile and one for the Jew. If you take those added words out, it reads like this. On the contrary, when they saw that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter to the circumcised. So there's one gospel, and it's being taught by both Paul and Yeshua's disciples. It's just one gospel. It's not two. It's just one gospel, two messengers, or two groups of messengers to two different people. It's basically all that's at. And then another confusing thing in here is in the words circumcised, or circumcision, or circumcised, and the word uncircumcised. And it's really important that we see this because it all adds to what we've been saying, what I've been saying all along here. In this passage in verse 7, the word circumcised is the Hebrew word, or Greek word, peritome. Okay, peritome is Strong's number 4061. And it literally means circumcised. Okay? Now, in Greek, if you want to make an opposite of a word, how do you make it opposite? So the opposite of peritome would be aperitome. Okay? And that's the word we should find there. But that's not the word we find there. We find the word acrostrubia, or something similar to that. Acrobustia. And all akrabustia means is having foreskin, or having the foreskin. And the Strong's Dictionary goes on to say that it means a condition in which the corrupt desires rooted in the flesh were not yet extinct. So akrabustia does not necessarily mean physically not circumcised. All it means is that, and it can mean physically not circumcised, but primarily what it means is that you're not thinking like a circumcised person. In other words, you're still in paganism, or you've discounted God, or whatever. So what this means is that a physically circumcised person could be considered akrabustia, or uncircumcised. And this is indeed the case, and it was indeed the case in that day and age. You know, remember the Jewish people were circumcised on the eighth day, if they liked it or not. You know, they didn't have much say-so over this. And there's a lot of Jewish people today who are circumcised. Circumcised on the eighth day, had nothing to do with it. And are they walking as if they were circumcised? As if they were part of the covenant? You know, don't want to be a judge, but there's a lot of people out there. I'm sure we could name a number of them. Go to Hollywood. About a third of the people in Hollywood are Jewish. And you can see how they conduct themselves. And you can see that they're certainly not acting like a guy who's, or a person who's walking with God. But they're circumcised. So they would fit into this category. Okay, so there's this difference. There's this difference, and we have to understand that uncircumcised does not necessarily mean physically uncircumcised. And so Paul, as we go on and continue on through this Galatians study here, we're going to see that this come up. To identify the problem, we've got to know these words and understand what's going on. Paul makes one last statement here that I want to bring up. And it's a translation error. In verse 9, it says, "And when James, Peter, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that had been given to me, they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship." In other words, they strongly supported what Peter and Barnabas were teaching. And it says that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. You see that the word "should go" is added words there. That's given to us to convey the idea that Peter and James and John were going to stick around with the Jews, and that Barnabas and Paul were supposed to go off to the Gentiles, and they were sent off to the Gentiles. But that's not what it says. It simply says that we went to the Gentiles, and that Peter and James stayed with the Jews in Jerusalem, pretty much. They weren't sent these different ways, necessarily. At least they weren't sent off by the Jerusalem brethren, the Jerusalem leadership. They went there because that was where God had led them to go. So, with that, I was sort of broken myself here in presenting this, but I hope we get the context. The whole thing here, and this continues on until we get to the end of chapter 2, Paul's still and continually trying to support where he's at, what he's doing to the Galatian people. He's still trying to substantiate his gospel message above the message of the perpetrators. And we'll finish this portion of this up next time in seeing that how Paul is doing this. And then we'll get into some of the really fun portions of Galatians and try to figure out some of these midrashes that Paul throws out there.